Hey neighbors, it's Jessica and you're listening to Love Thy Neighbor. In this episode, you're going to be listening to my white friend, Emily Hayford. I received some feedback that more people would like to hear stories of white people understanding their privilege, doing the anti-racism work, and encouraging other people to do so. So I hope that you really enjoy listening to this episode. I sure loved listening to Emily. And please feel free to leave a review below so I can know what I can improve on. And I'll see you later. Thank you so very much for coming here. I just wanted to see if you could quickly just give a little introduction about yourself.
Sure. My name is Emily, and I have been living in Bountiful for about 2 years now. I'm currently wrapping up my bachelor's at Westminster College, and I'm doing a custom major where I'm focusing on prevention and intervention of sexual violence through the arts. So it's been quite the journey, but I love it. I'm interning with the Rape Recovery Center right now, doing some really cool work. I've been married for about 3.5 years, and we have 3 super cute dogs at home, and we're hopefully going to be able to take a little break and go down to Zion's this weekend. So
oh, great. Forward to that. Yeah, I hope so. That's a good time. Yeah. And what kind of art have you been doing recently? What kind of things have you been creating?
Sure. Just because of how busy I've been with school and with a lot of the community workshops I've done, I haven't been able to do as much of my personal art that I like to do. So I've actually been finding like cooking and craft making, like more like crocheting, as more of my artistic outlet. But traditionally, I'm really drawn to acrylic and watercolor and stuff like that. But with the community, I'm working with the Healing Arts Group with the Rape Recovery Center. So I'm doing projects with their Healing Arts Group with the clinical team. And then I'm also going to be working with the prevention coordinator in their education programming and trying to bring in like art stuff with those programs. So yeah.
You're a rock star.
Thanks.
That's so many different things you have your hands into. It's awesome.
Yeah. It's what I'm passionate about. So I'm just trying to make a living out of it somehow.
Yeah. We'll see. And you will. It'll all work out. When you were growing up, do you know the first time that you started to notice that there were people that didn't have your same skin color or that looked differently from you?
So growing up, I moved every like 2 to 3 years, kind of moved all over the place. So I would say, honestly, my earliest memories are when we were in Saudi Arabia and we just had people from all over. Like, I know I lived in Baltimore before, but honestly, I don't remember much from it. But yeah, Saudi Arabia, I had a Japanese neighbor who I was really good friends with. I think I had a Swedish neighbor. There were plenty of kids that were, from like Ethiopia. There were kids that were Arab. And just, yeah, from all over.
And yeah. I bet that was a really good experience for you at such a young age. Because do you think that taught you to be a little more tolerant of those around you?
I think, honestly, it just, that was my normal. That's all I knew. So in addition to Saudi Arabia, we also lived in Switzerland for a time. And it was kind of the same. It was an international school. Most kids spoke at least 2 to 3 languages. And I was speaking more than 1.5. Like, I was really trying to learn French, but it was a little bit of a struggle. Yeah, and then aside from that, I lived in Ohio, Arizona, kind of traveled a lot. So I feel like Utah was more of the culture shock to me to see mostly white people, and that was a weird adjustment for me initially.
When was your first friendship with a person of color? You kind of mentioned how when you were younger, you had neighbors that were different than, looking than you.
I would say probably my best friend that I can remember was Shahira. She was... Her dad was Arabic, and then her mom, I believe, was from Europe. I don't remember from where. I want to say, like, Belgium or something. But, yeah, we were, like, kind of within the same neighborhood, and we were really good friends the 3 years that I was in Saudi Arabia, so that would have been, like, kindergarten through half of second grade.
Do you feel that the situations that you were placed with when you moved to Utah, so maybe whether that's school, maybe... socializing in your family or in your friend groups, do you feel like you could see that racism was kind of existing in a way, or that people were trying to teach it to you in maybe not direct ways, but in indirect ways?
I think just the school curriculum itself. Like, I remember growing up, we read books from all sorts of authors, different genders, different races. There were a lot of books that, like, focused on kids of color. So I remember one of my favorite books was, like, Lemon Meringue Pie or something. I don't remember exactly what it was called, but it was... I remember 2 little black kids, and I remember just loving the illustrations and, like, the super bright colors. But I feel like I didn't see a lot of those types of books when I moved schools to Utah. So, yeah, that was the biggest difference I noticed. I don't know if it's changed, though, because this was, like, 10 years ago. So, yeah.
Do you think a lot of it is just ignorance, that we've gotten so used to hearing one perspective or one race's way of thinking that we're just not aware of other types of stories.
I think that's probably part of it, and I think it's just if that's all you know, you don't really think about reaching out to something else, mm-hmm. honestly.
Yeah, and I think with more refugees coming into Utah, I think that's starting to kind of open up the opportunities to hear more stories, which I think it's awesome that Utah's letting in refugees when other states aren't. So.
Yeah, definitely. I think our population for refugees is one of the highest growing ones in the state, if
oh,
I
nice.
Remember correctly. Yeah.
Awesome.
So we're pretty good compared to other states.
Yeah, which is good. Mm-hmm. It's like we need more of that. When did you first recognize your white privilege?
I think when it really, really hit me hard, and I think I really understood it, was I served an LDS mission in Florida, southern Florida. And honestly, even going into it, I was like, oh, what's in Florida? A bunch of old people? Okay. I had no idea that it really felt like I was living out of country. Like, it was so many different mixes of people from so many different places, people from Haiti, people from, like, the Dominican Republic, all different parts of South America, Mesoamerica, Portuguese, Spanish, like, you name it. It was just everywhere. So I think just seeing the way that some people lived and seeing that, honestly, like, I did literally nothing in my life to earn the life that I had, to have the parents that I had, to have basically, like, we were always well off enough. Like, we usually had food to eat. I don't remember ever really financially struggling a ton. But there were so many people that I met that, like, in the States, coming from Haiti, living in a trailer park where they had just, like, dirt floor, and that was it. And I was just like, I had no idea people lived in these conditions in the States. I thought, like, everyone basically had my life, essentially. Mm-hmm. So I think moving back to Utah after I'd spent that year and a half in Florida, that really helped me understand that I need to do more and be more to be aware of all the things that I've done that I've unearned, if that makes sense. Unearned, I don't know, haven't earned. That really, in a way, kind of woke me up to, I guess, just how trivial things were that I thought were important in my life that really don't matter in the grand scheme of things.
Why do you think that a lot of white people get very threatened or frustrated when they're accused of having white privilege?
From my perspective, the people that I've heard that get upset about it, I think they genuinely believe you're accusing them of having an easy life and that they've never had any problems. And I don't think that's what we're trying to say when white privilege exists. We're trying to say you have had troubles, you've had traumas, whatever else you've had in your life, but the color of your skin has not been one of those issues. You have not suffered in a larger picture, in a systemic way, in an interpersonal way because of the color of your skin. So you've benefited from that, but yeah, you may have struggled in other areas. From people that I've talked with, and I think just parents who have children of color have to have these conversations with them early on, and that's something my parents never had to talk to me about, just because it's something that honestly I don't think they or I ever thought would be an issue.
Have you ever felt like you've been a white savior in any of your relationships or when you've been helping people of color?
I think I'm not 100% sure. Yeah, I don't know, like, if I'm being hard on myself or, like, if it's true. So I'm always wary and I try to make sure I'm not being that. But for a while, I did work with the International Rescue Committee with an age group. I think it was, like, 6 to 10-year-olds. And then I also worked with teens, like, 12 to 17. So I think with that program, I was trying really hard to make sure, like, the goal of it was to just help them adjust to living in Utah. So it was more teaching them, like, the ropes of where things were located, helping them feel welcome, helping them feel like they had a place and that, you know, they belonged. But yeah, I think that was always kind of in the back of my head to make sure, like, I'm not saving them. It's not because of me mm-hmm. that they're succeeding, but it's essentially, I'm just a vessel for them to be able to have the tools, like, to be able to adjust here, essentially. But yeah. It's not like some big grand thing that I was like, oh, I'm so cool.
Yeah, and you probably weren't taking pictures with them and mm-hmm. posting them on your social
right.
media and being like, look how great I am. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's really where the white savior comes out, is when it's all about you as an individual helping people instead of, well, the people that are being helped and, like, giving them the power and the attention that mm-hmm. they need. I mean, I've even thought in my life when I've been a white savior, there was a time, it was 11 years ago, where there was a singing group that came from Kenya, and I was asked to be a junior handler during the festival. And I just remembered like wanting to take pictures with the kids. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had really great friendships and relationships with them. But it seemed like in some of the situations I was in with them that I was trying to make it all about me and how mm-hmm. I was so great for helping these poor black kids from Africa instead of recognizing that I was just there to help and to not have it focus on me. What encouragement would you give to white people to help them not become white saviors, but to focus on helping people of color?
I think I've heard this before, and I don't remember where I've heard it before, but this is not like a direct quote from me. But the idea of handing over the microphone metaphorically. Yes, in some spaces it is important for white people to teach other white people just any toxic behaviors they have, anything that is contributing to racist ideals. But at the same time, in more of like a public forum and just in bigger spaces, being willing to, if you have the microphone, which a lot of the time I think that's kind of our role, is like white people have traditionally always had the microphone. So instead of speaking for them, being willing to hand it to them.
A few weeks ago, I think I had some thought go off in my head, like a stereotypical thought about someone that was a different race. And I remembered, what are some of the practices that you've developed to stop yourself from thinking, you know, biased things, stereotypical things, or racist things? Like if you're somewhere and then you have some thought pop into your head, like how do you stop those thoughts from like being made manifest in mm-hmm. words or actions?
I think that's a really good question. Let me think for a second.
Because it's tricky because we all have biases.
Right.
And we all have experiences. And there are some white people that if they've had any interaction with certain groups of people of color, it's been negative because mm-hmm. of maybe one-off situation.
Mm-hmm.
So then they think, oh no, that's how it is with everyone. So yeah. I'm trying to think of how to appropriately, you know, help people understand how they can just stop.
I think I shared this story with you earlier, so I can share it really quick. So essentially, the way I've learned to deal with any biases that I have, because I think a lot of the time when you hear the word bias, you just assume, oh, it's someone actively saying, I hate someone of color, which is not what a bias is. It's just kind of an assumption mm-hmm. one way or another. So for the first time in my life, when I was in Florida, I had one black roommate. She was from Philadelphia, so African American. Her dad was from Haiti. Her mom was from Philadelphia. And so she was honestly the first black person that, like, I saw her natural hair, and she was, like, spending time on it and everything. But she joked with me a lot about it. And then when I joked back with her, like, she was fine with it. So I just assumed it was okay to just joke about it and just like, have a light relationship mm-hmm. about that back and forth. But then I think a couple months later, I had another roommate who was from Nigeria. And so like a lot of the things we would joke about with that other companion was just like, if we saw weaves, just different places, we would just like make a joke about it or whatnot. So in a different context with this companion from Nigeria, I was in the car with her and three other missionaries who were also white. So I also didn't realize the context of that mattered a lot too. And so I think in passing, I said something about a weave and I made like a similar joke that I had with my previous companion. And in the car at the time, it seemed like everyone laughed and like it was fine. But after the fact, we got home, she let me know that it was actually something that was really, really hurtful to her. And she had a really hard time expressing that to me because, you know, it's kind of scary to be vulnerable. It's scary to always be the one that has to bring it up when like basically you're bombarded with it all the time. But it took me by surprise, honestly, initially, because I was just like, I had no idea that was something that would be hurtful, because with my previous friend, we had just joked about it all the time, and it was fine. So I assumed all black people would be okay with it. So that was my bias. It's just that's just what you do. So that was a really important teaching moment to me, to realize essentially not every black person is going to view hair, but a lot of other different things in the same way. And I'm not allowed to decide for them based off of a previous relationship what is and what isn't okay, and it's more I need to check in with them as a person and just kind of see where they stand and respect their boundaries and just realize that yeah, everyone views everything differently.
Whether you're religious, you believe in God or not, I think that you can kind of connect within yourself and say, like, check in with yourself. If you start thinking those thoughts, say, well, why am I thinking that thought? What made me think that? And I need to put an end to that because that's not an appropriate thing to think. And then if you go forward with that, kind of like how you were going forward with, I know that now about Black Americans and weaves, or mm-hmm. African Americans and weaves, you know better now, mm-hmm. and you can do better. What is your hope for the white race in terms of reconciling with racism?
I think the biggest thing is just acknowledging that as a white person, there is honestly no way you can understand what it is like to be a person of color. Like, you can empathize in certain ways and just be like, oh yeah, I have been treated differently in maybe X context or Y context, but to be a person of color, that's something like I personally am never going to know. So I think for white people, just being able to acknowledge that and being able to validate people's experiences and not just brush it off as like, oh, you just are being too sensitive, that's something that shouldn't be that upsetting to you, you should be able to get over it, all that stuff. It's kind of similar, and I think I've used this analogy before, maybe when we've been talking, I don't remember, but it's kind of the same as like, I feel like there's a lot of things that as women we go through that men don't go through, that as much as they want to be empathetic to us and they want to understand us, like, because they haven't lived it, they're never going to actually know what it feels like. So just having our feelings validated and feeling listened to goes a long way when we're trying to like work with allies that aren't men. So I think in the same sense, white people just need to really listen, and they just need to acknowledge, I might not feel the same way as this person who's talking to me, but I do need to validate what they're saying.
Yeah, I really like that. And before I head into the end of the interview, I just wanted to ask you just a little bit with your work in helping sexual abuse victims. Do you have any stats or information on how sexual abuse affects people of color versus white people? Like, I'm assuming that there's more abuse and harassment towards women of color. Is that true?
Yeah, I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but I know if you go to the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, so it looks like RAINN, RAINN.
Okay.
They have a lot of stats on that site, and that's RAINN.org.
Okay.
The National Sexual Violence Resource Center.org also has a lot of statistics, and the CDC, so Centers for Disease Control, if you just type in sexual violence, they have a lot of information as well. So those are good places to get like the actual numbers. What I do know off the top of my head is that yes, as a whole, women of color do experience more types of sexual violence, and I believe it's Native women who experience it, I want to say it might be higher than twice the rate of white women. Yeah, I wouldn't quote me exactly on that one, but I know theirs is significantly higher. And another really big issue tied to that is murdered and missing Indigenous women. And that is a really, really big issue that I think is being more light is being shed on it now. But what's really, really difficult about that is that when someone goes into a reservation that's not from there, so like anyone who's technically a U.S. citizen, will go onto a Native American reservation, and essentially they'll be able to like commit any type of crime. And as long as they leave, technically they're out of the jurisdiction. So that's why a lot of people commit those types of crimes on Native women, because they know they can get away with it, which is really, really messed up.
Wow.
So I think with the, I think there's like a specific group, murdered and missing Indigenous women, because it's a really big issue. And I think Utah is one of the top 10 states that it's an issue in. So like, we're really high up there, really, really serious. But I think there's a lot of different groups. Like if you type that in, my brain's everywhere. Restoring Ancestral Winds. So it's RAW as an acronym. Is a group that is very dedicated to helping people see the stats on that and helping Indigenous communities in Utah, but I think also throughout the states, I want to say, just be able to address that, but also a lot of other issues that face Native populations.
Mm-hmm.
So they're a really good resource, and I think they talk a lot about that as well.
I'll make sure to provide the web URLs for those websites that Emily just provided, because I want to go learn more. I think that'd be really interesting.
For Native women, most other women, trying to figure out how to say this, most other women, their perpetrators are generally, not always, but generally of the same race. But Native women is one of, I think, either one of the only or the only population where their perpetrators are not their same race. Because again, people feel like they're justified and they can get away with it.
Wow. Which they can really take advantage of them and do horrible things. Mm-hmm. Even though they're U.S. citizens, I mean, they weren't granted citizenship until the 20s, but they're still citizens. So therefore, they should have the same rights, but they're not given them.
Mm-hmm.
What's been also something that you've seen with generational trauma? Because that's really a big thing that I think a lot of people don't focus on, is that if some traumatic event happens to a grandmother in her youth, that it could be made manifest in a grandchild.
I went to there was a Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women's Conference last September, I believe, at the University of Utah. And I'd actually also taken a training through Utah Coalition Against Sexual Assault where I met one of the presenters. So I had already met her. Her name was Renee. And I believe she is from the Diné Nation. But she talked about her story where, because of her upbringing and because of the trauma that her family members had faced, she was put into those same negative cycles, and she did end up facing abuse from family members, from community members, and that drove her basically to a lot of different coping mechanisms that weren't super healthy for her. So she talked a lot about like drinking into like probably early preteens all the way up until her 20s.
Wow.
But yeah, I think with that intergenerational trauma, there's a lot of things people do to cope with it that they don't realize they're doing. So it could be maybe like high-risk behaviors where you're using like alcohol or something else to self-medicate. You could be using different relationships with other people in an unhealthy way. But yeah, I think it's way more related than we've realized before. And I know in one of my psychology classes, there have been tests shown on rats specifically that when a female rat is pregnant with a pup, if she experiences some type of trauma, then the offspring, once it's born, if it's put in certain situations, is more likely to develop some type of stress response, whereas the other ones wouldn't. So with people, they've been trying to do more research and studies, and I think that research is coming out. That is true of people too. It doesn't necessarily mean you're necessarily like quote-unquote doomed to that your entire life, but it does increase the odds that you may have to cope with a mental illness on top of everything else. That, like, if you take like a predisposition to mental illness, but then you throw on that like being treated differently because of the color of your skin, your socioeconomic status, having less access to things because of the color of your skin, like, that's going to probably be way more triggers than someone who, let's say, is white and they don't have to deal with all those things. Maybe they wouldn't develop it because they didn't have all those outside
stresses,
pressures,
putting that on. Wow, thanks for educating me on that.
Yeah, hopefully.
That's really awesome.
Hopefully I got it right.
But oh yeah,
that's what I remember from my good old days at SLIC. Enjoyed my time there.
That's great. How have you seen art help heal victims of abuse?
Well, let me think for a second. I've seen a lot of different ones. So something that comes to mind for me is I also went for school this past May down to the Hopi and Diné Nations, so down in southern Utah, kind of the Four Corners area, Monument Valley area. And so we were able to spend time with a couple of different families, and they were kind of showing us just like day-to-day life, the types of things that they would do, some of their traditions, some of the more intimate like family moments and whatnot. And one of the family members we stayed with, her name was Beanie, she showed us, it was like incredible because art is just so intricately woven into everything that they do. So like with the baskets that they would make, they would go out and get the yucca plant, they would dye everything, and then they would make patterns, but like it's also functional. So it's also like holding different things like food, making the corn that we ate at one point. But then also, she talked about going out to actually get the clay from the earth to make a bowl, and going out and getting like specific rocks and scraping them off for the paint, and then also using some of the reeds from the yucca plant to paint onto the bowl, but then also using that bowl almost as a trade, like with her family. I think she was saying that there was like a coming of age ceremony that her daughter had participated in that her cousins had made a specific headdress for, so it was like handcrafted with wood, it was hand painted, and as a basically thank you for that and to like pay back the family for what they did, she was making like specific bowls and then a pipe out of play for her cousin's son. And so it's just kind of, it's cool to see that the way that they're using their art and the way that it has been used for generations is, it's not just an aesthetic thing, but it's a process. You're connecting with the earth, essentially. You're connecting with your community. You're connecting with family members. And it's communicating gratitude for each other. And it's communicating connection and acceptance. And I think that's really important in the healing process, to just know that you have a place in the world and that you matter. And I think without that type of communication, that's where people feel isolated. So yeah, I think art's a really powerful way to do that.
It's getting harder, I think, for people to feel heard. And I think we just, as a whole, need to learn how to listen to other people. I think that's the biggest thing.
Would you say that advice, you would give that advice to white people to help them learn how
Definitely.
To love their neighbors better?
Yeah.
So just listening and trying to understand people better.
Yeah, there's something that, working with the Rape Recovery, they have an expression that I really like, and I don't know where they got it from, but it's something like, acknowledge the intent and educate in the moment, or something like that. I probably misquoted it. And I think that's more for white people to understand that that's what people of color are doing when they're trying to communicate with them when something is hurtful. Most of the time, well, a lot of the time, I can't say most of the time, when a person of color does bring up if something has been harmful, they're not trying to attack you as a person. They're trying to say, hey, this behavior hurt me in some way, or this behavior is damaging in another way, so that you can, like we were talking about earlier, essentially know how you're impacting people and you can choose to better yourself. So I think that quote, I would just help, or I would hope it would help white people understand that being corrected doesn't mean you're a bad person, and it doesn't mean that you're going to be stuck that way forever. It's someone being vulnerable with you, which means in a way they trust you, and it's an opportunity for you to be better and to treat other people with dignity, essentially.
So I wanted to thank you again, Emily, for coming. And your Instagram handle, the organization you started, could you tell the audience a little bit about that
yeah.
if they want to follow you and see your content?
I would love to. So I've taken a little bit of a break from it, but hopefully jumping back in when school is done. But yeah, me and a friend, Martina McBride, started We Can. So it's Women Encouraging, Caring, and Nurturing. Back in the summer of 2016. And I'll try to keep it short. I think at the time, this was a pre-Me Too world. So we had both had experiences of sexual trauma in the past and were frustrated that it just seemed like no one was talking about what kind of effect that has on you over a lifetime. No one was talking about how you can view it in a positive way after that's happened. And we're just kind of like, there's a lot of things we just don't talk about as women that we should talk about, and we should support other people. So essentially, we started a blog, which then ended up turning into actual groups where we met up and we invited women in the community to be part of those discussions. So we covered things like mental health, physical health, menstrual cycles, because that is not talked about enough either in women's health. And just really taking your body back. I think one of my favorite workshops that we had was with Jendar Morales. She was my sister's, not roommate, but I think one of her friends in college. And Jendar, I think, is doing yoga in a couple places in Salt Lake, so I can also send you information for her
Great.
Stuff, because she's awesome. But she, for I think 3 of our workshops, has done like a mindfulness meditation where she's done a guided meditation on gratitude for the body and each part and what it does for us. And then she was able to, I'm trying to remember, yeah, do that gratitude meditation and just really focus on reclaiming your body, which I think is really important for survivors, like reconnecting and really being able to just have that power back. And after the first time we did it with her, we had about 13 women present, and most of them said that they didn't even realize they had something tied to sexual trauma necessarily, that they had disconnected with their body previously, but they said through this workshop they didn't even realize like they had needed that reconnection, but it brought that to them. So yeah, my hope is that in the future, once I'm done with school and everything else, I can actually turn this into an actual business or nonprofit where we can serve women of all different ages, all different backgrounds, and hopefully have like a physical center. But I also would like to have an outreach for those who can't physically make it, because I know not everyone can physically come into a specific place because of just a lot of different restrictions.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the overall goal one day.
Well, thank you. This is really enlightening for me. And I'm sure it will be for the audience.
I sure hope so. Thanks for having me.
Of course.